Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the American healthcare system stack up against what is available in the rest of the world? We spend a far greater percentage of our gross domestic product on healthcare than any other industrialized democracy, but our outcomes lag behind our peers on everything from lifespan to infant mortality. Now millions of uninsured Americans are awaiting expanded coverage opportunities promised by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. But will it be enough to bridge the gap to healthcare access in America, or could it bring an ailing system closer to collapse? T.R. Reid is a longtime correspondent and former Tokyo and London bureau chief for The Washington Post. He explores these questions in a new book, which has just been updated to explain the provisions of the new healthcare law. The book is called The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. Tom, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Great to be on the air.
You see healthcare first and foremost as a moral issue. Do you think that's a common outlook in this country?
Doesn't seem to be. No, I think the key point of my book was, you know, I went around the world to see how these other countries manage to cover everybody, and as you said, spend half as much as we do on health care. And I found the biggest difference was all the other countries made a commitment. They just decided, doggone it, we're a rich country, we're going to provide health care for everybody who's sick. I think that's a moral commitment. I think that's a sense of obligation to your fellow citizens. In America, we've just never made that commitment. And my argument in the book is, hey, if we decided to do it, we could cover everybody at reasonable cost. You know, hey, look, if France can do it, the United States can do it. I'm sure of it.
One of the huge differences is that our health insurance industry is, for the most part, almost exclusively a for-profit industry.
That's a big difference. There are a lot of countries, rich democracies, that have private health insurance. It's not all socialized medicine out there. A lot of countries cover everybody with private docs, private hospitals, and private insurance. But in those other countries, the insurance companies are not allowed to make a profit. And here's the theory. The thinking is there's a conflict between paying for people's medical care and paying a profit to investors every quarter. And if you have to pay your investors a dividend, well, then you find ways not to pay claims. You don't cover anybody with a pre-existing condition. You hire hundreds of thousands of underwriters to deny claims. You shut off people if they get sick, even if they've been paying their premium. These are all things that our health insurance companies do, and they say they have to make a profit. In the other countries, the insurers have to cover everybody. They have to pay every claim. Usually they have to pay in a day or two. They pay very fast. They can't cut you off once they take you on. The difference is the only purpose for those insurance companies is to keep people healthy, to pay medical bills, because those other countries think it's just wrong to let the profit motive get in the way of caring for people's health.
Why hasn't the nonprofit sector sort of stepped up to try to take a larger role in healthcare in this country? I mean, there are nonprofit hospitals, not for profit, I should say.
Yeah. So here's what we're going to do, Chris. I think it's useful in this regard to divide medical care into two halves. One is the providers, mm-hmm. that's doctors, hospitals, drug companies, people who provide the care. And the other is the payers, the insurance companies, or in our country, Medicare or Medicaid, who pays. Most rich countries that cover everybody have decided that the providers can be private, for-profit, that works fine. Hospitals, doctors, drug companies, labs. But they've all decided that the payment scheme, whether it's government or whether it's private plans, has to be non-profit. Now, that was the case in America. Healthcare in America started, actually, Blue Shield started in Texas in the 1930s as a way to help people pay their doctor bills and hospital bills during the Depression. And it was always nonprofit in every state until about the late 1970s. And then these big insurance companies like Aetna and WellPoint and United Health started buying up local nonprofit Blue Cross plans and turning them into for-profit. That's when we got in trouble, really, because once you're for-profit, that's when they start turning people down for having been sick in the past. That's when they hire people to deny claims. And that's a fundamental difference between the United States and other countries. If you have nonprofit payment, and they pay every claim, and they don't take people off the rolls for having gotten sick.
You anchor the book with a story of a young woman who was diagnosed with lupus, working hard to take good care of herself but could not find coverage. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yeah, Nikki White was a 32-year-old college grad. She lived in Austin and had a pretty decent job, and she got lupus, which is this happens to women in their late 20s, and it's a serious disease, but it's totally treatable in all rich countries, including the United States. If you have lupus and you have good insurance, you're going to live a normal lifestyle, 75 or 80 years. But Nikki lost her job. In America, when you lose your job, you lose your health insurance, and then she fell into this terrible netherworld. She had too much money to qualify for medical care under Medicaid for welfare programs, but she had too little money to pay for the doctors and drugs she needed to stay alive. She died at age 32 in the world's richest country. This woman died at age 32 because she couldn't get medical care in our country. And according to the National Academy of Sciences, that happens to about 25,000 Americans every year. Well over 1,000 every year in Texas die of treatable diseases because they couldn't afford a doctor. And this is really, I started my book with that because the point is, if that woman, Nikki White, had lived in any other rich country, Japan, Britain, Canada, South Korea, Germany, she'd be alive today because they cover everybody. And this is really the fundamental difference. We are letting tens of thousands of our fellow Americans die of treatable diseases because we've never come up with a system to cover everybody.
Well, and it's interesting because you've written about our outrage and dismay over the lives lost on 9/11. And that number, although shocking and horrific, is lower than the number who die every year of treatable diseases.
Yeah, isn't that striking? We lost about 3,000 Americans tragically in 9/11, and we've spent hundreds of billions of dollars since then to make sure it never happens again. That seems right to me. But the same year, 20-some thousand Americans died of treatable diseases because they didn't have health insurance, and we're not fixing that. More people are dying every year of treatable diseases because they can't afford a doctor. And one of the arguments I make in my book is if Americans knew that, I think if people knew how cruel our system was, that our neighbors are dying or going bankrupt in huge numbers because they don't have health insurance, we'd fix it. But I think a lot of Americans still believe we have the best health care system in the world, and that's really what I went around the world to see. Is it true? And as you said earlier, other countries cover everybody. They spend less, and most of the rich countries have better health outcomes than we do. So, you know, we're the richest, most powerful country in the world, but, man, when it comes to keeping people healthy, we're a third-rate power.
So you explored all this through the lens of a shoulder injury that you'd had since your time in the Navy. Can you talk about what you, sort of your experiences in different parts of the world, seeing the kind of treatment that might be available to you?
Yeah, Chris, I bashed my shoulder when I was in the U.S. Navy during the Vietnam War, and I'm old now, and over the years, it's kind of frozen up. It hurts a lot. It doesn't move real well. And so I decided to get it fixed. I mean, I was writing a book about healthcare systems around the world, so, hey, I'll take my shoulder along with me and see what happens. So I went to doctors and hospitals all over the world, and here's what I found. In America, the preferred solution to my problem is to give me an artificial shoulder. Give me a new shoulder made out of titanium. That procedure costs about $47,000 in the U.S. I did find some countries, Japan, Germany, Switzerland, would have given me the same operation. It would have been a lot less. In France, it would have cost about $5,000. But a lot of countries said, no, you know, you're living a pretty good life. We don't need to spend the money on that. They suggested therapy. They gave me in Japan, they gave me steroid shots. This is interesting. My doctor in Britain, where everybody gets health care free, you never even get a doctor bill, he said it's a nice system, except it's kind of stingy. There's a lot of stuff they won't do. And the doc in Britain said, you're living a good life. Go home. Live with it. You know, we're not going to fix that. And in a strange way, that kind of helped, too. I mean, I went home and said, okay, I can't swing a golf club anymore, but the rest of my life is okay, so I'm putting up with it. So I got a whole series of different proposals. The most striking thing was whatever anybody proposed was vastly cheaper than it would have been in the United States.
Your experience in Japan almost sounds like fiction. You called the equivalent of sort of a rock star orthopedic surgeon, and tell us what happened there.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I was complaining, as I often do, Chris, about my sore shoulder one day, and it was a Thursday morning in Tokyo, and somebody said, well, you ought to go over to Keio University Medical School. They have this great orthopedic surgeon there, Nakamichi. So I called Nakamichi's office to get an appointment, and the receptionist said, well, why don't you just drop by this afternoon? That's what happens in Japan. Most people don't make appointments. They just show up. And I waited, 35 or 40 minutes. And, Chris, you know how in your American doctor's office, you're in the waiting room there, and a receptionist comes out, and she says, Tom, you hear it like that, right?
Yeah.
In Japan, she says, Tomasu Rido-sama irashaimasuka, which means, has the highly honorable Thomas Reed graced us with his presence today? Which I think was quite nice. I like that. And I went in to see the doc, and it was pretty interesting. He sat me down at his computer and went through all the different possible remedies for my sore shoulder, shots, treatment, acupuncture, or this surgery for the new shoulder. I said, well, what if I did the surgery? How long would it take? And he says to me, he looks at his schedule. He says, oh, tomorrow I'm really booked up. Maybe someday next week. So that's what I say about Japan. They have a very, very healthy, the longest lived population in the world. They use health care like crazy. They have no waiting, basically. And very cheap. They spend half as much per capita on health care as we do, and they cover everybody, and we leave 50 million uninsured. So, and it's a private system. It's private docs. They have more private hospitals than the United States does, and mostly private insurance. The government picks up the gap for people who are unemployed, but mostly private insurance in Japan. So I thought, well, that's not a bad model for us. It's not big government nanny state medicine, and it works pretty well.
Well, what about the experience that you had in England? And a lot of people worry about the system in Canada and this huge, weighty, poisonous phrase, socialized medicine. Can you talk a little bit about what that actually means?
Yeah, that's really a good question. Because what does socialized medicine mean? You know, I give talks around America, and I always ask people this, and generally people can't define it. We know it's bad, right? But we don't know what it means. I think the system that I found in Britain, the National Health Service, is socialized medicine. In that system, government owns the hospitals. The doctors in the hospitals, the surgeons, the radiologists, et cetera, they're government employees. The nurses are government employees. The technician is the guy taking your x-ray is a government employee. And then you don't get a bill. Government pays all the bills. So, man, if government provides the care and pays for the care, I'd call that socialized medicine, wouldn't you?
Sure.
But there's another system that I found in many countries, kind of the Canadian model. In that model, government pays the bill. It's a government-run health insurance system that you have to pay into. But the provider, the doctor, the hospital, the lab, the drug company, they're all private businesses. So what do you call it? Half socialized medicine? You know, semi-socialized medicine? And that's the model we use, incidentally, for Medicare. It's a government payment to private doctors. We took that model. We copied that model from Canada. That's the Canadian Medicare system. Is Medicare socialized medicine? Most Americans don't think so. And then, strikingly, in a lot of rich countries, Germany, Switzerland, Netherlands, Belgium, France, to a degree, Japan, private docs, private hospitals and private nonprofit, but private insurance plans. So, if anybody says, we can't cover anybody, that would have to be socialism. No. Many countries cover everybody at reasonable cost with good quality in a completely private system. In fact, in my book, I argue that many of these countries are less socialized than the U.S.
Let me have you stop there. We need to take a break, Tom.
Okay.
T.R. Reid is my guest. His new book is called The Healing of America. We'll be back in a moment, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist T.R. Reid. His book is called The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tom, as you pointed out, the system of Medicare sounds very much like a socialized program, if that's how we want to define it. Most people who have it report they're pretty satisfied with it. On the other hand, there are questions about the amounts of reimbursements to providers. Can you talk a little bit about that issue?
Yeah. Doctors are complaining bitterly, and hospitals are complaining that the amount of money they're paid by Medicare is not as much as the amount they're paid for the same procedure by private insurers. And many doctors say they can't make money on Medicare patients. I'm a little dubious about that myself, because standard procedures done on Medicare, like my shoulder replacement, for example, cost 3, 4, 5 times as much in the United States as in other rich countries. I mean, and there are some variations. We are a more expensive country in some ways, but not 5 times as much as expensive as Japan or Germany. So I think there's some room there. Everybody wants to cut federal spending and reduce the deficit, and we're all going to have to sacrifice to make that work. And I think doctors, frankly, are going to have to sacrifice. They're going to make less.
So the new healthcare law puts a cap on how much insurance companies can spend for administrative costs, but that cap seems just unbelievably high compared to other countries. It's 20%.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the major reasons that we spend more than all the other rich countries on health care and get less is because so much of the money we pour into health care goes to paperwork and bonuses and training, and it doesn't really pay anybody's medical bill. And the big insurance companies have administrative costs. This is like marketing, underwriting, bonuses, trips, travel, et cetera. At least 20%. On some plans, it's more than 35 cents of every premium dollar goes to paperwork. And to kind of crack down on that, the new health reform bill, the bill a lot of people call Obamacare, finally put some limits on the insurance company's administrative costs. And guess what? This led to a year-long negotiation over how you define administrative costs. But in a year, those limits are going to take effect, and in theory, I think they will lead to smaller increases in premiums or lower premiums, because the insurers are going to have to put more money into paying your bill and less money into paying their executives.
Another thing the new law does is put new taxes on the profits of insurance companies. What is to say that those insurance companies don't then pass that additional cost right back on to their ratepayers?
Well, that's a very good point. Now, in theory, health insurance, if the Obamacare plan works the way it's designed, I'm not sure it will, but if it does, health insurance should be much more competitive. Nowadays, most people in America, 50% or more of the people who have health insurance, only get one or two choices. You get whatever choice your employer has settled on. If you work for the federal government, they get 10 or 12 choices, but in my company, we get one. But under Obamacare, everybody in America will be able to go on the Internet and go through a list of between five and 20 different health insurance plans for their family, the same way you buy an airplane ticket or a hotel room on the Internet. You pick the plan you like best. They're all competitively priced. And then the company has to sell you the plan. They have to cover you regardless of your medical record. So in theory, that should put a control on costs on premiums, because the companies will now have to compete in a way they don't have to. Now,
so the expectation is that about 32 million additional people will get coverage through the expansion of Medicaid, and also through these other systems that are set up by the states and by the federal government. But there are still something like more than 20 million Americans expected to be uninsured by 2019. What's going on there?
Yeah, to me, that's a really serious failure of this reform plan. They never set out to cover everybody, and covering everybody is really the secret. As I said, all the other countries have decided to cover everybody. It saves lives, it reduces illness, it reduces suffering, and it saves a ton of money. all the countries that cover everybody spend half as much as we do. So I think on healthcare. So I think that failure in the reform bill to get to universal coverage is really a serious shortcoming. Here's what happened. The bill calls for, as I said, people can go on the internet and buy an insurance plan, and if the premium is more than 8% of your income, that's about $350 or so a month for an average family. The government's going to give you a subsidy, and they just couldn't afford all the subsidies to cover everybody, so they cut it off. They're going to get 32 million more people insured, but about 25 million are going to remain uninsured under Obamacare. So I think that's a real serious shortcoming, and I'm not even sure now that we're going to get to the 32 million additional, because the Republicans won election promising to cut Obamacare, and if they cut the subsidies, then we won't even get to the 32 million that was originally planned.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. T.R. Reid is my guest. We're discussing his newly updated book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. We'll go on the phones now to Ellen in Dallas. Hi, Ellen.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I am a physician in Dallas, and my observation has to do with rationing.
Yeah.
A study just came out of Yale in which nephrologists were asked nationwide, would you still do dialysis on someone even if they had dementia? And about 50% of the nephrologists said yes. And this information was used, I think, in a RAND publication. So the point is, we have a medical industrial complex, I think, and nobody who is getting a piece of the pie wants to give it up. And we cannot seem to come to grips with the need to ration. So that's my comment.
What do you think, Tom?
That's such an interesting comment. So rationing of healthcare is a bad word. It's not. We're not supposed to do it. But you know what, Chris? As the doctor knows, every country rations healthcare. No country can afford to pay for everything modern medicine can do. So when you hear, well, those other countries, they ration care, that's true. That's absolutely true. I talk about it in my book. But guess what? The United States rations care every single day. Millions and millions of proposed procedures that doctors want to do are turned down by insurance companies. And, of course, the 50 million people who don't have health insurance, they face a much tougher form of rationing. In many cases, they can't even get to the doctor until they're sick enough to go to the emergency room. So, yeah, we completely ration. Many countries have a kind of board set up to advise doctors and would say, in the case that the doctor just told us, if somebody is over 95 or something and in the state of dementia, don't spend the money on dialysis. The United States hasn't done that, and particularly for elder people, because we've got Medicare, and Medicare is pretty generous in what it covers. We don't have that kind of control. But I just want to point out, we do ration medicine in America. We ration it by not providing or providing very little or none to people who don't have insurance.
And I guess, you know, people who have insurance, care is rationed as well. If your insurance company says, you don't actually need that much physical therapy or something, and you either do without or you pay for it out of your own pocket.
No, that's exactly right. Our insurance companies have all sorts of rationing mechanisms. You know, this business of in-network and out-network, we'll pick the doctor you can go to, and if you don't like her, tough luck. Other countries don't have that. In France, Germany, Britain, Japan, Taiwan, you can go to any doctor, any chiropractor, any clinic, any hospital, and insurance has to pay. They just don't ration through this networking system. So you're right. Even people in America who have insurance have it rationed. Most plans have a yearly limit on how much they'll pay. That's going to be outlawed now under Obamacare, but you know, you say, oh, man, it's going to pay up to $800,000 of my bills. That's really good, unless you get hit by a truck, and then your bill's going to skyrocket past that, and they stick you with the extra.
Well, let me ask you this. Can we afford this? I mean, $940 billion over the next 10 years that the federal government alone has to chip into this?
Yeah, the bills, the Congressional Budget Office says expanding Medicaid and providing subsidies for people to buy private insurance is going to cost about $940 billion. And as you said, they raised this through taxes. They're going to tax insurance companies, drug companies, hospital corporations, and they're raising the Medicare tax for rich people. Can we afford it? I think the answer to that would be, can we afford not to do it? Because health care is going up at double or triple the rate of inflation. It's already one out of every six dollars we spend in our country is spent on health care. It's going to go up to 20% of all our wealth. I think we've got to do something. And this new reform bill, look, it's not great. It doesn't cover everybody, but it does have some cost controls in there. This is what the hospitals are complaining about now. So, look, we've got to put some controls in. And the problem is anytime you put in a control, your political opponent says, oh, my God, he's cutting Medicare. Yeah, we're going to have to cut Medicare. We won't be able to afford anything in our country.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phones to David in Frisco. Hi, David.
Hello. Yeah, I'm a conservative, and I think that we've got one of the best healthcare systems in the world. And I get really irritated as people continue to try to push us toward government healthcare. But I've got to say, you've made probably the best argument I've heard, and it's probably come the closest to changing my mind. I don't think we can have it both ways that we can say, we want to cut taxes and give people back money, and that's going to spur the economy. And at the same time, you get to look for more and more of that disposable income is going to health care. And what happens if we were able to give some of that back to the people instead of maybe taxes, give it back some of the, what they're spending on health care that they can spend on other things? I've got to believe that would, you know, have a good effect on the economy as well. So I just wanted to say it was a very convincing argument.
Thanks for your call. You want to respond at all, Tom?
Yeah, thank you very much for listening carefully. I'm grateful. Look, for some people, we do have the best health care in the world. If you have really good insurance or you have a lot of money in America, you're going to get the best treatment in the best hospital from the best doctor in the world with no waiting. The problem with our system is the 50 million people who don't have insurance and basically don't get care until they're pretty sick and can go to the emergency room. So overall, for a population, we don't have the best healthcare system in the world. And Chris was talking earlier about the statistics that show we live shorter lives, we get serious chronic diseases sooner, and for most major diseases, we have lower, shorter, worse recovery rates than other rich countries. So, yeah, some people get fabulous care in America, but overall, for a population, we don't. I think you got to put some controls on the cost of the system. We need to put controls on these outrageous administrative costs, which is at least get started in the Obamacare bill. And the fact is the big buyers of medicine, Medicare and Medicaid, that's 47 million people in Medicare and 40 million in Medicaid, have to use their market power as big buyers to get some cost controls, and they haven't done that, and that's because of the political power of the drug companies and the hospital companies. But that's the way to do it. I think turning the dollars back to individual consumers won't get us any control. I'll tell you what. Here's what happens. You go into your doctor, and she says, oh, my God, you've got thoromycin syndrome, and I'm going to have to put you on 100 milligrams of this expensive generic, this expensive brand-name drug. What are you going to say? You're going to say, doc, couldn't I get by on 30 milligrams? I mean, you just don't know enough to get the cost control, and that's why we need the big buyers, Medicare and Medicaid, to actually get some cost controls, and then it would be good if consumers and private insurers followed those models. So far, they haven't done it.
Well, let's talk about drugs and medical devices. What do you make of the argument that, yes, we pay more for these things in this country than in a lot of other industrialized, wealthy countries, but that our money also subsidizes some of the best R&D in the world?
Yeah, I think it's a baloney argument, and I'll tell you why. It's absolutely true that the United States is a world leader in medical innovation. We make great breakthroughs, and the rest of the world uses them. But you know what? Other countries with much lower cost structures also make really important breakthroughs. I'm on this drug called Crestor. It's a cholesterol-reducing statin.
Mm-hmm.
It's licensed by AstraZeneca, American company. It's licensed from a Japanese company. They invented it. Viagra, you know, the drug that's most advertised on TV, that's a British invention. Ultrasound, so that you can see your baby in the womb and see what's happening, that's a Swedish development. Anybody listening to the show is walking around on an artificial hip or knee, you know, those artificial joints, that's French technology. So Yeah, we have great technology, but I don't think we have to pay through the nose to get it, because other countries that pay vastly less than we do also have great medical technology. I think that's a baloney argument that they came up with mainly to juice up their income, not really to juice up research.
Tom, do you expect the new healthcare law to make the actual costs of the medical procedures and treatments that we need more transparent? It's still pretty much impossible to know what something really costs.
I completely agree with that. And as long as there are 30 or 40 different payers, Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, and then all sorts of private insurance plans, yeah, it's going to be very hard, because each provider negotiates her own price, or the hospital's own price, with the different payers. And therefore, you can't know. I'm on the board of a hospital in Colorado where I live. We do about 60 hernia repairs a week, same medical team doing the same procedure, and we get 60 different prices for it, depending on which plan is paying for it. So it's very hard. In the other countries, they basically have standardized. There's some regional variation, but there's one price for a flu shot. There's one price for a hernia repair, and you know what it's going to be. Get this. In France, you go to your doctor, and she posts on the wall the prices for everything she's going to do. You know in advance how much it's going to cost. No American doctor could do that, because we have so many different payers. And this is also part of the huge administrative cost. The poor doc has to keep 100 forms in the back room and never really knows what she's going to be paid. So if we got to a simpler system like all the other rich countries have, man, we'd save tons, and we'd also know what the procedure's going to cost in advance.
T.R. Reid is my guest. He's a longtime correspondent for The Washington Post, also author of the book The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. It's just been updated to look at the new healthcare law, and it is available now in trade paperback. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist T.R. Reid is my guest this hour. We're talking about his new book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Srinivan in Dallas. Hi, Srinivan.
Hi, Chris. Great show. Fantastic topic. And I'm a physician myself, and I should commend Mr. Reid. It's a great book. I've not read it, but, you know, by the way you're discussing, I can see that you have done in-depth research. I got my training in India, and I've seen the other extreme, and I feel like in the U.S. it's the other extreme. I think the system is totally riddled with problems from top to bottom. Unfortunately, I feel like if you take any aspect, a physician's aspect, huge problem. There's a patient's aspect, a huge problem. But the way I see is, there's no simple answer to this, unfortunately, and I don't think our government can afford to provide free health care to the whole country, because this is not some Kuwait or Brunei where we got tons of money and limited population, and you can say, hey, everybody's covered. Now, we are here in almost 300-plus million people, and also everybody wants first-class care. Unfortunately, who's going to pick up the tab? You know, we're already in debt for $14 trillion. Our GDP is $13 trillion. How can you afford this? And also, people have unrealistic expectations. You know, I see patients who have no health insurance. We still take care of them. It's not like we ignore them or we I mean, 2 a.m. when I get called, I go and still treat them. I don't see whether they have insurance or not. I do whatever I need to do, and then but turn around, and then I realize that the person doesn't have insurance. I've not withheld any treatment or anything for that patient, but the patient will turn around and ask for more stuff. I mean, which is, they don't even have, they think that they're entitled to this. Unfortunately, elsewhere in the world, that won't happen. You know, the way I see it is, they're limited, you know, first-class seats. Not everybody can fly first class. Like it or not, that's a bit of fact.
Well, that's a good response for you, Srinivan. I think those are some great points and some really understandable frustration there, Tom.
Yeah, look, I thank you very much for reading my book. Thanks. You asked, how can we afford this? And the answer is, if everybody's covered, you actually save money. I know this sounds counterintuitive, but you can see in my book, all the other rich countries cover everybody and spend half as much. Now, why would that be? Well, one reason is you get what the doctors call early presentation. So some guy in Britain feels kind of a vague pain on the right side of his abdomen. He can go into the doctor for free, and the doc says, oh, I see you're having a problem with your appendix. Let's deal with that. In America, an uninsured person feels that vague pain down there, but, you know, couldn't dream of paying $125 to see a doctor. So 6 months later, that same guy goes into the emergency room with a burst appendix, and now we're looking at a very, very expensive procedure that could have been avoided if we'd had medical care from the beginning. So that's one way. And then another way is for the big payers to use their market clout to get prices down. I don't know if you know this, but under law, Medicare, which covers 46 million mainly elderly people, is not allowed to negotiate with the drug companies to get lower prices. It's nuts. I mean, any big buyer will use his market clout to get better prices, but the government hasn't been able to do this. That's because the drug companies have very strong lobbies in Washington. So there are definite changes we could make to get the prices we pay down, and getting everybody covered, although people don't, I keep saying this, and it's true in every other country, it would save money.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next, let's go to Tim in Southlake. Hello, Tim.
Hi, I'd like to thank you, Chris, for doing a great show.
Thanks.
I lived in Malaysia for 2 years, and I really depended to listen to it. And when I was living in Malaysia, my health care for a year for a family of three was about $650. I moved back to the U.S. My health care is about $1,600 a month.
Yeah.
It's just not about 20% administration fee. What about the legal issues? And by the way, I also could show up at the doctor. Sometimes the doctor call, I'm early. Can you come in now? It works spectacularly well.
Yeah. The legal fees, the malpractice system, nobody else in the world does it the way we do it. Nobody uses malpractice lawsuits to compensate patients who are injured. Every country has patients who are hurt in doctors by doctors or hospitals. It happens, unfortunately. Nobody compensates them from the tort system. It's just a terrible way to do it. You have a jury of lay members who don't know medicine making the decision. Much of the money never gets to the patient. So I think that our malpractice system for dealing with medical errors is a terrible system, and we ought to fix it. And it's a big shortcoming of the Obamacare bill that they didn't even touch it. But I'm not sure it's going to save a lot of money. For example, some states in America, including Colorado, where I live, and Texas, where you live, have put really strict limits on malpractice judgments. Rick Perry, your governor, says Texas has the strictest limits in the country on malpractice judgments. And guess what? Healthcare costs in Texas are going up faster than the national average. If it is saving any money for the doctors, they're not passing it on to their patients. So I don't think the Congressional Budget Office said that the malpractice system adds about half of 1% to the cost of health care in America. Well, that turns out to be a lot of money, but it's not going to make a huge saving. I do think we ought to fix the system because it's a rotten system for doctors and for patients, but I don't see a lot of financial saving in it.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Ed in Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Hi, this is Ed in Dallas, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I lived in England for 17 years, and I want to make a couple of comments about the National Health Service. The first thing is, is that there's a parallel service, private, which people can buy insurance for. So if you're in a real hurry or if you want a luxurious suite, as opposed to being in a ward in the hospital, you can get it. Second thing, anecdotal, my stepdaughter and her husband are both British physicians. They would not think of moving here because there they're able to practice medicine rather than worry about the business of it. Hmm. Third thing, also anecdotal, my mother-in-law, not a wealthy woman, not at all well off, living in East London in 1994, suffered a stroke. I was there. She got care immediately without having to worry about costs. She's alive and well now on the high side of 80. And finally, there's somebody in my family who has lupus, and I heard the account of the woman who died of lupus earlier, who is getting absolutely superb care and has been getting it for 20 years. I just get kind of tired of hearing the British system trashed, and that's all I really had to say.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I lived in Britain, too, and we used the National Health Service, and it was great. I mean, the care was good. We didn't wait. Well, sometimes we had to wait, but we didn't really wait longer, too much longer than in America. And you never get a bill. You know, you go to the doctor, and you walk out, and there's no bill. There's no copay. There's no deductible. There's no nothing. And therefore, you don't have the three-month fight with the insurance company over who's going to pay the bill. So I like the system myself. I thought it worked fine. Ed is right that there is private insurance in Britain, and it's cheap because the NHS covers most things. So, but as a matter of fact, it turns out most people, when they get sick, rely on the NHS. Only 3% of all the spending on health care in Britain is done through private insurance. I had a buddy, she had good private insurance through her employer, and she had a baby, and I said, well, you're going to go down to this famous private hospital, and this woman said, oh, no, for something as important as having a baby, I'm going to trust the NHS. And I think that's the general mindset there. People tend to rely on the national system, even though private insurance is cheap.
Well, what about the small things that are done for luxury, for comfort, for marketing purposes? Ed referred very quickly to the idea of having a luxurious suite. And anyone who's been in the hospital knows it's nice to have your own room. But are we paying for that when we could, in fact, provide care to more people if we sort of gave up some of that?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. It's certainly true that we have the fanciest, most comfortable hospitals that I've seen in the world. I've been to hospitals all over the world. Most places, they don't spend much money on the physical plant. You know, you go to a hospital in Britain, they got buckets in the hallway catching the leaking rain kind of thing, you know. The care is fine. The physical facility is not that great. And it's an economic decision they made to put more money into doctors and nurses than into the room. I don't know how to assess that. I, too, like being in a clean, attractive room if I'm in a hospital sick, so that's just a trade-off. Anyway, it's not a very big part of our health care costs. Our costs are due much more to the administrative burden, to the overlapping system, and then just the high prices we do pay for procedures, vastly higher than are paid in other countries.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Tom in Arlington. Hey, Tom.
Yeah, you were talking about the price transparency. In our current American system, we don't have anything like competitive pricing that we do in other industries. Like, you look at construction, manufacturing, energy, the so-called free enterprise industries, you can get a price quote, an estimate. But in medicine, you can't really get a price quote 90% of the time. The insurance companies that pay the bills have a government-licensed antitrust exemption. They're basically a licensed monopoly, so they avoid competition. So the vendors and the payers make a profit on hiding costs from consumers, and that's why they don't want it to change. It would cut their margins. And if you could shop for medical care the way people, you know, went on the Internet for Black Friday or Cyber Monday in the past week, then we would have true free enterprise in medical care. And as it turns out, countries that are controlling to some extent medical care, they're actually more price competitive, which we think of as a capitalist free enterprise quality. So we don't have free enterprise medicine in this country, and I wish people would understand that.
I totally agree. I think that's an absolutely telling point. New hospital shows up in your town, and they don't have a grand opening price special like every other business would do, and you don't know what the price is. And as a matter of fact, the doctor who operates on you doesn't know what she's going to be paid for doing that surgery. It depends on your plan. So this is all part of this ridiculous administrative complexity of our system, and it doesn't have to be there. Other countries have one price all over the country for a flu shot, and they save money and people are really healthy.
What is in the new healthcare law to encourage Americans to try and take better care of their own health?
There's a lot in there. They're now going to allow companies to charge a lower health insurance premium for people who are have a reasonable weight or can get their blood pressure down to a safe level. There's just a lot of encouragement now to show people that a better lifestyle will keep you healthier and therefore reduce healthcare costs. Another thing is, it's going to require McDonald's and Dairy Queen and Pizza Hut, et cetera. All the chain restaurants are going to have to list the calories for every item on their menu. And the theory is maybe people won't have the 900-calorie hamburger if there's a 150-calorie alternative.
Yeah, it's kind of a scared straight alternative, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's like warnings on cigarette packs. You know, we have really reduced the rate of smoking in America through education, not through restriction. I think we could do the same with our obesity problem. If people knew, they'd be better eaters.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Frank in Dallas. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Okay, Tom, I read your book. I studied health policy at University of North Carolina, and your book was required reading. Loved the book. Thank you so much.
We like that. Thanks.
And so my question is, you know, you talked a little bit about the business end, and you talked about how we can really cut down on administrative costs and you know, the business costs. But, you know, here in the U.S., I work for a hospital system here in the Dallas Metroplex, and we spend lots of time analyzing quality metrics, core measures, abstracting. And anything we do in the hospital is looked at over and over and over for price and quality and was it required, you know, was it necessary. And in other countries, I mean, I know we have standard metrics that we track and, you know, the World Health Organization tracks against, but do they analyze every single transaction over and over? And, you know, what kind of diligence do they do in tracking quality over there?
What about that, Tom?
Yeah, Frank, thanks so much for reading my book, and that's an excellent question. Many countries do have a national board. In my book, you read about NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence in Britain, and they try to study different procedures. They look at results by region and by hospitals to see who's doing a good job and a bad job. The Japanese are very, very good at this, and then the Japanese basically tell you which procedures the system can pay for, even though they're private insurers. The health ministers decide whether or not they're going to pay for a procedure that they don't think is worth the money. So, yeah, other countries are doing that. They tend to be doing it on a centralized national scale because prices tend to be nationalized in those countries. They're the same everywhere. We tend to do it like your hospital, at the hospital or at the company level because everybody charges a different price, and every insurance company pays a different price for the same procedure.
T.R. Reid is a longtime correspondent and former Tokyo and London bureau chief for The Washington Post. His book is called The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. Tom, thanks very much for joining us. Take care of that shoulder.
What a great show, and very good listeners. Thank you so much for having me on.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.